Hi, and welcome to the When Women Fly podcast. Each episode, I have poignant conversations with women who fly, run, surf, ski, climb, or otherwise soar, and possess a passion for life that is infectious. These are honest and insightful conversations about dreams and reinvention, often in the face of uncertainty, doubt, or other impediments. We talk about busting paradigms, grit, working hard, and playing hard, all while building a community around the empowering metaphor of flight. I am your host, Sylvia Winter, a pilot, runner, mother, skier, list maker, and apparently podcaster. I believe that when we share our stories, own our fears, and dismantle our perceived limitations, the possibilities are boundless. Whether you're pursuing your passion or simply love the idea of possibility and wonder, this podcast is for you. Thank you so much for joining me today. Let's get started. Hey, it's spring, 2021. How are you, listeners? Often I wish the podcast wasn't the one-way street that it is. I talk with a guest and push out episodes to you, and you, loyal and curious you, listen. But I wonder what are ways we could interact more to debrief. I'd love to hear from you. As spring brings all sorts of optimism, I see the potential for what can be done with the abundance of character, drive, thoughtfulness, and motivation within this community. Perhaps we jump on Clubhouse, share ideas, and connect. You can send me an email at hello@whenwomenfly.com or DM me on Instagram. Thanks for listening. Your messages and reviews mean so much to me. I read every one. So it's spring. Hooray. Hooray for the vaccine and the rejuvenation that nature shows us in infinite ways. This week's episode, we chat with Sasha Golish. And the conversation is an enthusiastic snapshot of a woman who moves physically and mentally at a rapid pace. So buckle in. She has been a competitive athlete in many forms: runner, cyclist, duathlete, triathlete, and ultimate frisbee player. She was named 2015 Female Athlete of the Year in track events after winning 3 gold medals and 2 silver medals at the Canadian Intercollegiate Championships, the most individual medals ever won by a distance athlete. However, her entrance into pro running started at age 32. As a Canadian and a gifted athlete and the daughter of 2 doctors, working hard is in her DNA, but so is having fun. She grew up skiing and playing outdoors in many forms. Talking to Sasha is like sitting down. Well, not really sitting down because both of us are standing at desks and connecting remotely, but it is like going for a run with a friend who is both a philosopher and a contestant, a player, not one to sit back and watch the world pass by without jumping in. Whereas some extremely intellectual minds tend to remain there in the intellect, Sasha is deeply connected to her body and the way her movement relates to her environment. She holds a PhD in civil engineering education and spends an inordinate amount of time sweating, smiling, making fast turns, and contemplating engineering efficiency at the intersection of math, aerodynamics, kinematics, and flight morphology, especially as it relates to resiliency and performance. As Sasha takes her penultimate lap around the sun before she drops into the Masters League at age 40, she thinks about the synergies in her life, the interplay between fear and courage, the importance of risk, the duality of whimsy and constancy, resiliency, and just what makes the world hold meaning for her. If you are only just discovering the When Women Fly podcast, or if you have been along for the ride, I post new episodes every week. If this sparks something in you, follow, share, and review. You are part of this project. Enjoy the whimsy and levity, along with the logical and level-headedness in this conversation with Sasha Golish. Sasha, welcome. It's such a pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to be speaking with you.
So you are a pro runner and a performance engineer, to oversimplify your identity. But I would love for you to give us a little background and tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I'm going to start with the now, because often we go back in time and I'm like, let's talk about the now. It's a fun time. So I'm teaching at the University of Toronto. I actually went to the University of Toronto for much of my degrees, minus one, because I needed to go somewhere and party for 4 years. So I'm teaching at the University of Toronto, working in engineering, mostly with mechanical and industrial engineering. I'm working a little bit with first year math right now. So that's sort of the professional side. And I guess my other professional hat is I'm a pro runner, and I run with a company called Oiselle, which is the feminine word of oiseau, so bird, so flight, which is, I think, how we got connected.
Yep.
Very, very immediately, I have been researching flight, like quite literally the equations for flight. So the equilibrium diagram of like how one stays, you know, moving forward. So thrust must be greater than drag, and your lift must balance weight, which for those of you who don't know math, let's just say birds are cool. Yeah, we do cool things when we're in flight. Airplanes do cool things. So I'm really interested in the performance engineering world of that intersection of sort of the engineering sciencey stuff and how that relates to our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I was inspired by you when we first chatted to think about this, about all of the things from Oiselle that keep me in flight. And when you start to fall, all the things that help pick you up and minimizing that drag, and how do you minimize, you know, the burden, the weight on your shoulders to reach even higher goals. So I have a lofty goal at the age of 39 of trying to make the Olympics this summer. I don't really care if the Olympics go ahead, like leave that aside as to that why, but I just want to, in a sense, prove to myself that I can still run the standard on the track. And so I'm trying to do it in a respectful way, given the tragedy really of COVID, but also as a pursuit of excellence and a way to motivate myself every day, because I live through this value of to be better every day. And it's kept things fun when things have been challenging for all of us.
Oh my, I have so many questions just from that. Oh, this is going to be fun. Okay, so let's just, for a moment, let's unpeel. I want to talk about now, but I also want to just touch on the framework of your background, because I think that's relevant. And then we can dig deeper into some of these other topics of engineering performance or performance engineering and flight and all of these fun things. So just talk to me a little bit about what your childhood was like, what your parents' expectations were of you, if there were any, which of course there always are, and just the influence and culture in your family.
Sure. So I grew up in Toronto, and actually both my parents are affiliated with the university and always were. Both my parents are doctors. So I'm going to answer your expectations question first, mostly because it really makes me smile. So my parents had, probably as most parents do, high expectations, but it was high expectations on working hard. And it wasn't to say that just because you work hard, you're going to get the result that you want, but they wanted to reward hard work over grades and accomplishments. So it was about the process and not the outcome. Having said that, I was, you know, sort of, yeah, I guess your stereotypical young woman who strived for high grades, get into the right school. On the athletic side, we, as a family, played a variety of sports. So, I mean, I'm laughing as I say, like, we skied, but like, for most people who grew up in the mountains, you'd be like, we don't, that's not skiing. That's our bunny hill. Ontario basically has no mountains. Sylvia, I think one of the things we connected over to is that, you know, we as a family would drive down to Vermont, and those are some of my favorite memories of getting to go to ski at Killington and, you know, watching my mom ski Outer Limits, which is this massive mogul hill. So we had high expectations, but my parents lived through that value as well, right? Having high expectations for themselves and always demonstrating hard work and perseverance and resilience. And we did a lot of stuff as a family. We did a lot of stuff individually, but in a way that was super supportive of each other. I think, you know, my parents are both accomplished physicians, but I think my dad was definitely, you know, one of the first male physicians to kind of say, I'm happy with what I'm doing. I'm an accomplished surgeon, but that at the same time, I'm going to let my wife pursue her goals as well. Like, I remember when we were little, my dad got offered this really big job down in Georgia. My dad's a big golfer, and it was kind of near the Masters golf course. And the first question he had was, you know, like, well, what can you offer my wife? You know, my wife is this accomplished anesthetist. And they said, well, we'll come down and we'll talk about it. And, you know, the first thing is they referred to her as Mrs. Gollish, and my mother kept her maiden name. She's Dr. Houston. And they basically said, well, you're not going to work. You're going to take care of your children. And my mother was like, in no world is that happening. My husband's far better with kids than me. And, you know, like, we would have had a very different life. And he was offered an inordinate amount of money, but he just went, no, because that doesn't support the person I love the most in life. And, you know, that's a value, I think, that speaks to what our family was about. And we're still to this day, like, super close. COVID, when it first happened and we couldn't see each other, was so challenging for us. You know, my mom's actually, as an anesthetist, I remember saying to her when COVID first happened, like, okay, you can either go to the grocery store or you can save people's lives with COVID, but you can't have both.
You can't have that risk of doing both.
Yeah. You can't have that risk of doing both. And she, you know, she's like, my calling is to be a doctor and save lives. So she stopped going to the grocery store. It was, I would get to see her because I'd drop her groceries off. So I had a very charmed life for sure. I had a very privileged life filled with lots of love. And I think that's why those high expectations were such a positive influence in my life.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like passion was something that the family culture embraced as well.
Yeah, and still does. You know, my mom's 66. She'll be 67 in April. I remember celebrating her 66th birthday by dropping a cake off and leaving. Again, COVID. But she has this passion, you know, again, to always do better. And so she took on this vice dean role at the University of Toronto in the medical school. And she's done amazing things to change it. And it's, you're right, it's totally because it's a passion project for her.
Hmm. So for you, science and math were a passion at school, or at least an interest area, more than the arts. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't... So game the system, right? I didn't like how in the arts it was very subjective and you couldn't get high grades. And knowing that you then couldn't get into the right school, I didn't pursue them in education, but I definitely pursued them outside of it because it was about the freedom to do what I wanted. So it's funny. So I'm a voracious reader now, and I love the fact that I can interpret stories the way I want to interpret them. And there's no right or wrong. And that really frustrated me with English class, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they said, no, this is what the book is trying to tell you. And I was like, well, I don't want it to tell me that. No. You don't do very well on tests when you say no.
Right. So you really gravitated towards the science, and being an athlete sounds like it was always something that was part of your life, but you didn't really get into the pro side of it until fairly late. Is that right?
Yeah, almost really late in terms of like pro athlete. I started it, right? I became a pro athlete at 32, right? Like most people's careers are ending at that point.
Well, especially in running, right?
Right. But I kind of quit after, I'll go with the US term, I kind of quit at the end of, I did two undergraduate degrees, but at the end of my first undergraduate college degree, because I was burnt out and running for the wrong reasons, right? I had lost the passion. I in a way lost the excellence. I wasn't training through that value lens of work hard. I was seeking outcomes and I was injured all the time, which makes it no fun at all. And I guess looking back now and having, since I've been, came back, having just the most incredible teammates, I didn't have the greatest sense of teammates around me. And it was just an age division. Like I was the only undergraduate college student on the team and everybody else was a graduate student, right? I was an 18-year-old, like fun loving kid with a bunch of people who were super serious at school. There's a little bit of a values-based conflict there.
Right. It sounds like a mismatch between what you were sort of, you thought you were positioning yourself for, and then some of the realities of that. And so, but burnout at fairly early age, really. But it must have been a pivot that then when you recircled back to academics, tell us about what that was driven by.
When I was picking my college courses and my college major, my brother had broken his femur and I really didn't know what to take. And I hadn't had an opportunity to meet with my guidance counselor because actually when my brother broke his femur, my parents were traveling on business. They were at a conference in Vail, Colorado, which was, yes, one of the worst phone calls I've ever had to make. So, but I didn't get to pick a major based on the courses I was taking. I was like, oh, I'll just take a business degree at U of T because the coach I want is at the University of Toronto. And business people make lots of money. So that's a good reason to go into that. meanwhile, I had, you know, all three maths and all three sciences, and quite clearly was probably meant to do something different. And really what was, despite not having those arts courses, was a creative person. And so engineering was that natural fit. And I sort of figured that out as my running career, kind of that burnout happened. And my the other part is my dad's an engineer. And he's like, well, why didn't you study that? And I was like, I actually didn't know what engineering was, Dad, as bad as that is. And I became really immersed in academics. And when I graduated high school, I actually didn't want to go to college or university. I didn't want to study anymore. I didn't think that I was the academic type. I really sort of saw myself going into the trades or just working right away, you know, and looking back now, I have a PhD. I obviously was that academic type, but I just needed the space to find the passion for what I really loved. And because no one had really pointed out like how passionate I really was about math and science, like I remember standing on the ski hill computing potential energy into kinetic energy, because at the top of the hill, while you're not moving, it's all potential energy. And somewhere in the middle of the hill, there's a balance between potential and kinetic energy. Like I obviously had this passion. And so the pivot happened as I sort of burnt out from running, but it wasn't really a burnout because I got so excited to go into engineering and go to the University of Western Ontario that I guess in a way, I also was much younger. Like I skirted through that very unscathed.
Mm-hmm. You skirted through the first undergraduate attempt?
I did reasonably well at my first undergraduate attempt. I just really didn't like business school. Like it just was not, it was quite clearly not for me.
Yeah. You know, I think it says a lot about what you were in your early 20s or not even at that point.
21? Like little.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is this sort of pressure to like figure it out. And gosh, I just feel like there should be more leniency to pivot laterally and do a 180 and just embrace that as part of that phase. It sounds like you did, you know, you went back and you right into engineering and that seemed to be your calling. And it doesn't sound like you've regretted that or diverted from that, but that has taken on different shapes since you started. I'd love to talk about the being the scientist and being the athlete and that crossover and through the lens of a scientist and a performance engineer. Obviously you love numbers, right? And you love data, right? And oh my gosh, you know, running is so much about the metrics and time and rank. And, you know, it's hard sometimes to even sort of value anything but that. So how do you set goals? How do you sort of approach your mindset as it bumps up against numbers? And yeah, it's that whole sort of balance between the intuitive and the data driven.
Well, so maybe, you know, like just thinking out loud here, and I've never phrased it this way before, but maybe instead of thinking of running as a science, it's the engineering of running. So all of a sudden you bring in the art side, right? So STEM is no longer STEM, it's STEAM, right? It's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And I think that's a really, really important distinction, particularly in engineering and the appreciation of the arts. Mm-hmm. And so how that relates to running is, one, I for sure sometimes forget that A and get way too wrapped up in the numbers, like we all can. But when I give myself the place and the space and the opportunity to think about the abstract and the art form of it, it really lets me set some goals that others might not see as clear cut necessarily or as definitive, but to me, it goes back to this process and not the outcome and the blend of joy. Because, you know, one of the first things I said to my coach when I came back to run at 32 was, the second I'm not having fun anymore, I'm out. Mm-hmm. And I've come pretty close to being out because I've lost the joy of it. So that mental state, that goal setting, that even stepping up to the line to battle your greatest rivals, there's still got to be some aspect of joy in it, which I think is the art side and not just the numbers.
Mm-hmm. So do you consider insights that come out of your engineering that affect the way that you train and you approach competition? And what are some of those, if you can be more specific?
So I think the number one thing, and this started right back when I came, is, so it was the force metrics. So on the science side, so running efficiency, the amount of force you're going to get out of the ground. So it was hiring and working with somebody who could teach me to maximize my stride to get the most out of that. And I worked with this wonderful individual, and I shouldn't say worked. I mean, I still, when I can, work with this wonderful individual called Dr. Chris Shepherd. And he runs this great clinic in Toronto called the Runners Academy, which kind of gives away all of the amazing things that he can do. So Chris is a chiropractor by trade, but he has this fascination with science and engineering and how do you maximize an athlete. And not necessarily just the elites. Like his whole thing is, well, every runner should do this because why wouldn't you want to be more efficient? And more importantly, it has minimized injury in such a way, which totally makes sense, right? Overstriding, understriding, poor mechanics. Like you can think about all the biomechanical challenges that you would come up against. So the first thing I did and the one thing I absolutely still spend, you know, the most of my like little time, like the little things that you do is absolutely on stride and making sure I maximize the efficiencies. One of the things that I'm trying to do and not to do is Eleanor Roosevelt's quote, comparison is the thief of all joy. How and what you compare is really important. So yeah, it's important to think about how much mileage you're doing and comparing it to what you've done before and building. But I think that's important within a cycle and not necessarily compared to necessarily seasons before. Because I think every cycle, which is for anybody, any race that you start training for, there's something different and there's a little bit of nuance. And definitely compare some stuff that you've done before, but don't do it in a way that, again, steals the joy of what you're doing, but also then kind of steals your mojo for what you're doing. So I'm not, especially this winter with, you know, you were talking before, you guys got mixed precipitation. We weren't supposed to get any snow last night and we got 10 inches.
Oh, so you did get our snow.
We really got your snow. I was went out to shovel and I was like, what? What? I was not expecting this. But, you know, I've been Nordic skiing and, you know, running to the treadmill takes a very different amount of time every day because who knows what's on the road running there. And some days it's like, well, I shouldn't run to the treadmill because it's too icy or there's just too much snow. So always sort of like thinking about getting better, but not in the nitty, thinking about it in such the nitty gritty terms.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just thinking that's probably an asset as a more mature athlete that you bring to the table is that lens of being able to have perspective.
Took a while to get there. Yeah, it wasn't easy.
Right. So you can say that now at 39, but it's not like in the 20s you had that. Absolutely. I can understand that.
Not at all. And I think it's a little bit of like, take the advice, but you need to live the advice. And I think you can get away with things when you're younger, but you also have it, you don't have the lived experience, right? I've got a host of successful workouts and a host of failed workouts. Mm-hmm. And I still have a host of awesome, successful outcomes. And it not necessarily the great workouts that made it. And it's not necessarily the workouts that I failed that didn't make it. It's not even just the lessons that I learned in resilience that helped me make it, but it's the everything together. And that's really the wisdom that I think I have now that I wish I could pass on to everybody and anybody in any sport or any endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are limitations in being a scientist and athlete?
I think only if you allow yourself to see them. I think you have to, Brené Brown, put courage on and be vulnerable to the fact that it might not be the outcome that you want, but you have to try.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we let the data try and tell us that we shouldn't try. But I think you just need to talk back to the data and say, yes, I can.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about resiliency, because I think that's a great segue to that. Pre-COVID, you on your blog wrote about resiliency. And I've just wondered, since you wrote that body of work release in 2019, how have your thoughts changed, evolved? What has this period brought up for you in terms of resiliency and coping?
Definitely as much as possible, thinking about actually taking the breaks and really not letting outside people judge me. I did, unfortunately, almost a year to the day later, let it get the better of me. In December, I was in, I'm not going to call it a dark place, but I was pretty down. I was really burnt out once again for different reasons. I had a mid-year review with somebody who basically said I wasn't pulling my weight. And I was teaching across 15 different courses. And a, as opposed to pushing back and following my own advice, I didn't. And I just took on more, which just leads to burnout because there's only so many hours in the day, especially in December, as a whole bunch of things need to be assessed for students. So more often than not now, and especially in the last year, I take those breaks that I need to recover. And especially the time in the woods. You know, when I realized I was burnt out, I was in Vancouver, which is rainforest mania. And I, at the time, you know, I'm a very unique individual. I had emailed or texted my friend Jonas, who lives in Vancouver. And I said, Jonas, totally burnt out. Can't do this cross country race. What do you think about hiking up the Grouse Grind with Rawl and I tomorrow morning? He's like, you are unique. Most people would say, like, let's go for coffee. I was like, oh yeah, let's get coffee before we go up the Grouse. But that connection with nature reminded me how important it is to get outside. And shortly after that, I basically tricked my partner into getting a puppy. And I think in a way, I knew it was going to force me to get outside and get into a park every single day. She's been like, she causes inordinate amounts of frustration. This is a good thing. She's super cute, but she gets me out and into the woods or out into nature. Like today we were hiking across the ice volcanoes on the lake. She gets me outside every day for a lot of time. And I think that's really helped me remain resilient. I think, and I seeing it, you know, I see it on social media and you see it and we all see it. Our friends that are stuck inside, you can't be resilient. You can't work on the skill of resiliency. You're alone. You lose that connection with nature. You lose that connection with people. And, you know, I've just tried to continue to remind myself of the things that I need, you know, little bits of joy so that I can bounce back up if I fall down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that connection with the outdoors and adventures in the outdoors.
Yeah.
Can we just dig into that a little bit? Can you describe your connection to the outdoors?
Adventure. I think you summarized it best right there. I was, so my friend Chris and I, we went for a ski probably Friday. I don't know days, right? So anyways, we're in the woods skiing and we were talking about, you know, Chris and I, like we've got this group text of all the people who kind of live around here. And it's like, hey, who wants to go skiing? Right. And I let people pick a time usually. And I'm like, okay, let's go. And it's often Chris and I. And Chris and I were talking about the chance to go on an adventure every day. And most people, I think, unfortunately, see physical activity as I need to do this because it's important for my health. But if you flip it in a different way and you go on an adventure, I think you get so many more benefits. And I think adventuring, as opposed to being active, is a skill. And it's a skill that everyone can learn. I think some of us, kind of like all skills in life, are born with it. I was for sure born with the adventure gene. Like, okay, let's go on an adventure. What's it going to be? Like, I'm pretty much open to anything. But I think we need to always be working at it, you know, no matter where you are on that scale. And I think the other part of it is learning about Indigenous culture and their spirits and their beliefs. And I think they are probably going to use poor terms here, but I think they hold the keys to adventure. Like, I think they're the birthplace of adventure. And they're they have a connection with the land that is admirable that I think we all can learn from. And I'm trying to even more so learn from, so that you can be connected to the land and nature and your surroundings in a way that's really powerful. And not in a way that I think when you resent what you're doing, like when it, whatever physical activity, I think it's actually more dangerous than actually not being active.
Yeah, there are lessons all around us if we're willing to see them, I think. And you know, the getting out into nature really does offer so much as far as resiliency and just shifting the mindset. It's really neat to hear you talk about that as amongst the other influences, just you where you are now, that being in nature and just frankly having fun out there. And I really get that sense from you that that's a really important value as well. It's really neat to see.
I think more than that, it's the disconnection. Like, people are often like, you must never sleep with all the things you get done. I was like, are you kidding me? I'm the greatest sleeper of all time. I could sleep anywhere. But I think to be super productive, you have to disconnect and to go connect with nature. And it's like a computer reboot, right? Like you have to clear the RAM. So I got to go in the woods.
Right.
I got to unplug. I'm going to clear my RAM. I'll be back. And
is that what you're saying when you said a few minutes ago that we have to work at it, the adventure piece? Is that because we junk it up so much with all the other things? And so it's kind of working at unpeeling and just really the simple act of getting out there?
I think so. I think a lot of people are afraid to get out there. And like, I get that. Like walking into the woods alone, like maybe not the smartest thing to do. Totally the smartest thing to do, right? Like I often bring my phone with me on the off chance that I like, okay, I have been lost in the woods. So I'm really thankful for the blue dot on Google getting me home. But can you bring your phone with you just to have it? So like you don't open text messages, you don't open anything else. You run maps in the background, you take pictures because there's often unbelievably beautiful things that you should look at again when you get home. But it's a willpower and you have to work at it. And if you go into the woods and you're on your phone, you actually miss the woods, right? Like you're not actually looking up at the wonderful things around you. But even in the gym, when I used to go to the gym, and I had to basically stop going to the gym because like we'd get so aggravated, not with like lifting. I love lifting, but seeing so many people unable to disconnect at the gym and just be focused on what they're doing and then have really poor form in what they were doing. I was like, oh, you're going to hurt yourself so badly.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I love lifting weights and I think other people do as well. And I think there's benefit to that, like going in nature, but I think it's this willpower and the skill of the ability to disconnect.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's neat to talk about that in terms of the resiliency topic as well as a tool. I'd love to talk about some of your experiences where you were really required to draw on your resiliency, and we can frame it. I like kind of thinking of it as an adventure in and of itself, but if you could just talk about Doha and your experience there. And
hot. It was so hot.
Yeah. So just for people that weren't tracking this, just give kind of an overview of what was going on.
Okay. So Doha was the 2019 World Track and Field Championships. So Doha, lovely Middle Eastern country, small Middle Eastern country, hot. So the championships were held later. So they started on 30 days out of September. So September 30th, the first event was the women's marathon. And they had thought by holding them later that the temperatures would have been a little bit more amenable. They had planned for the worst for the track events because really can't do this for the marathon. They had an air-conditioned stadium for the track and field events, which they had to use every day. The women's marathon was the opening event, which I think is wonderful, right? You're in an Arab country where a little bit more traditional values, and you've got the women's marathon going first. It unfortunately was 45.8 degrees centigrade, which I think worked out to be 117 degrees with the heat index. Yeah, like it was like getting into the sauna. It was quite literally like walking into a sauna.
Right.
And we were asked to run a marathon. So just not the best conditions for sure. I really respect Dr. Stacy Sims' research. I unfortunately got my period right around the race, so the day before. So my core temperature was elevated. So I had a few things against me.
Mm-hmm.
I had also broken my foot warming up for the 10K road championships in early May. And so my training, while consistent, had been very much cross training. And I'd really only been running for about probably 4 weeks, which is when you'd really be going into a taper for the marathon. So I didn't really get a big build in. I had done a great deal of work in the pool and on the bike. Like I was fit as can be.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't go the way I wanted. So the quick and dirty story is I stopped at 20K. And at 18K, I realized I had stopped sweating, which just when it's 45.8 degrees centigrade outside, you should always be sweating. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just slow down a little bit and see if I can make myself start sweating again. There were ample water stations and sponges and all this. So I get to that and I drink some water and I sponge myself off. And like a minute later, I'm dry. I'm like, oh, this is terrible. And at about 19K, I started to get shivers. And I was like, oh, science. I have heat stroke. I know what's coming. So 20K was the start finish kind of area, like, well, just before the start finish, obviously, where all the teams had tables with your drinks and everything else. And I got to where our sports physiologist was. And I was like, Trent, I've stopped sweating. He's like, do you need me to tell you to stop racing? I was like, I sure do. I was like, I'm not making this decision. He's like, you need to stop now.
Mm-hmm.
And some magical things happened that night. My friend Lindsay Tessier finished 9th in the world. It is a really special night. The days following for me were where my fallout was. I wasn't going to let my tragedy overshadow Lindsay's triumph. And so, and I still celebrate Lindsay. But in the days following, I felt like I'd failed my country, like I'd failed the head coach, my family, my friends. I was just kind of like out of it. And I mean, we raced at midnight. So I was also just out of it because really messes with your sleep schedule.
Yeah, sort of in every way you were out of it, right? Your body had broken down. It had just sort of ceased to do the thing you were asking it to do. And your time clock was completely upside down because you were trying to cater towards the running in the middle of the night. And just completely, it was what an incredible test of just your sort of being human in those conditions.
I was human. But
seriously, yeah.
I was seriously human. I was like, I'm melting, but I was actually melting. Yeah. We got a report. My core temperature, I think, was 41 or 42. Like I have it somewhere, right? Like I was dangerously hot. Like I'm very lucky that there was really no damage.
Yeah. Just fatigue or exhaustion afterwards?
Just exhaustion. Just pure exhaustion. So I was asked to give a lecture about my experience in Doha. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to talk to about the student? So very, very tragically, the minute I started my race, a student at U of T committed suicide in engineering. And I felt that best thing I could do for the students was talk about resilience. So I spoke about it first through an engineering lens and how we build resilience into bridges and buildings and everything else related to earthquake design, which is very simplified and probably not doing a very good job at that. But that we also had to do that. And I got to being able to talk about it when I was out. I like basically didn't take a break after the marathon because why would you? I've been injured. I need no break. Just keep running. Foolish. So I'm out running in the neighborhood. I'm listening to Brené Brown on, I can't remember whose podcast. She said, I'm going to tell you something that's going to change your life. You need to sit down. And I was like, well, Brené has spoken. I will stop running. And thank goodness I did because I would have fallen. And she said, it's about the story you're telling yourself. And in that moment, I could let go because I could tell myself the story that I didn't let the coaches down. I didn't let my coach down. I didn't let my parents down. I didn't let my family down. I didn't let my friends down. That I was still an incredible runner, an incredible athlete, an incredible instructor, an incredible family member, just great part of my community. And I could change my own story.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have the power to do that with simple, simple tools. And I think that's what got me through, respecting the grieving process for sure, right? Mm-hmm. Like I need to grieve the fact that this was not what I wanted, not what I trained for, but outside of my control. And really, I think with resilience, that separation of the things that you can control and the things you can't control really help you identify the things that you build upon in your realm of control on the positive side of things.
Yeah. And the story you're telling yourself, that seems like it was such an important part for you to unpack.
I do it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
We all fight with our partners. And I often have to say to him, we're fighting because this is the story I'm telling myself. And when you start there, you're all of a sudden like, we're not even on the same page. So let's start there.
Right. Let's talk about the dysfunction of this narrative, and then we can start to talk about the issue that seems like it's the issue, but it's really
it's not
just a gauze for the real issue. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you were teaching, I don't really know if that's the right word for it, but when you were talking about resiliency with the students, and you know, in some ways we teach exactly what we need to learn, right?
Right.
So do you find yourself sort of giving and taking your own advice? And when is that hard? And when is that actually sort of exhilarating?
So it's really challenging to take your own advice, right? So I've implemented this tool where I basically will text a friend. It's usually Lindsay Tessier or Catherine Watkins. And I'm like, this is what's happening. And this is the advice I would give you if it was happening to you. So this is the advice I'm giving to myself. And because you then have this dissociation from yourself, you can then take your own advice. I have to it's not, I'm not perfect at it. It is an ongoing process and I work at it every day.
Hmm. Are there certain areas that are more challenging for you to, in the advice category?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm stubborn, right? Like I never want to miss a workout. I never want to feel like I'm not doing enough of the right things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes I need to give myself the advice, like slow down. So on Friday, after we had talked last week, I texted my coach and was like, I need to take a day off. And I went back through my logs and I hadn't taken a day off in a month, right? Like it's just, it's been a winter wonderland here of playfulness.
Yeah.
Didn't take my own advice though, right? Of like, make sure you rest, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a good check-in. I'm pretty much okay. I have a hamstring tweak right now, not from any of that, but because I'm not very good at Nordic skiing and I went down a hill with way too much snow and way too fast. And unlike alpine skiing where you can rely on your tails, my tip sank so deep that I touched my toes for the first time in a long time. It's like the pain was like 0.5 out of 10, but at 39 and not 21,
right?
You don't go do the workout. You do the workout cross training and in another way to just let everything settle down. And that's when, you know, at the beginning we were talking about like, I was going to go into banking and commerce because it was like a job for the future. And I don't measure my life that way anymore, but I also need to recognize my own limitations. And that's where I struggle to take my own advice. That I'm not that 21-year-old not going into business. I'm 39. Like some things have happened, some great things have happened along the way, but just respecting my own body, that's where I struggle to take my own advice.
Yeah, I get that. And especially I think as the sort of, there's that 40 pivot point where I think you can kind of in your 30s get away with like not necessarily taking your advice.
Right.
There's some implications, but then it's like, actually, no, like your body's like, not going to show up if you're going to treat me this way. An athlete, a master's athlete does bring on all different challenges, really.
You must do the little things.
right. The little things. Yeah. So my question was like, do you bring your engineering mindset into that approach of being healthy, having a durable, I shouldn't say do you, because I know you do. You're extremely thoughtful. But how do you use your engineering mindset to sort of apply that to having a durable, sustainable, having longevity be part of your value?
I think it's robustness, if I think about it deeply. Robustness and rigorousness are the two like key academic words these days. But robustness is, it's bigger than strength, right? It's holistic strength. And I would give up 10 minutes of a run to do my activation and stretches after. One of the things I struggle with trying to teach and train professionally is eating, not from a disordered eating aspect, but, oh my gosh, I've been outside for 2 hours and I haven't looked at my email and I need you to go look at this. And now the fridge is 4 feet away and as opposed to going to the fridge and getting a snack, I'm diving into whatever emails I need to answer. That's not robust. Robust is the emails can wait another 3 minutes, get the snack, also have a whole bunch of snacks ready to go because that's a barrier, right? So removing those barriers so you can be robust and then just being really connected to your body, right? So like other people would have just done the workout I did today. Like I had no pain in my hamstring, but it felt weak and unstable. And that's a very different sensation than orthopedic pain. And I just got off the treadmill and I texted my coach and I was like, I'm 4 minutes in and I'm feeling this. I didn't include I've stopped. And he was like, oh my God, stop immediately. I was like, oh, I did that. Sorry. Right. Because I now have that connection and know to stop, but most people don't and would just keep going. Right. So he sends the emergency text back. You put sort of that engineering lens on where it's like, there's a little crack in the armor now. Don't let the crack spread. Right. Mm-hmm. Heal the crack before you keep going so that you can be robust and strong. And this actually ties back to resilience. I think one of the coolest things about resilience engineering is the fact that something can be disturbed and knocked down and afterwards it's stronger because it's designed in a way to be resilient so that when it takes that force, it's stronger after it's been impacted. And I think that's really the lesson that I'll bring forward as I move more into my master's athlete years and probably what I'd want to teach the younger generation. You can get away with cracks when you're in your early 20s. You get to your mid 20s, respect those cracks. And if you do, you will come back stronger and better than you ever imagined.
I love that. I think there's a lot of wisdom in thinking about the durable and long future. It's sometimes I think it's really hard, though. I think it's hard to not get overwhelmed in the short term.
Totally.
Yeah. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've had to overcome related to balancing your competitive pursuits and your career?
I work at an institution where people wear busyness as a badge of honor. And even if I wasn't a pro runner, that wouldn't work for me. I wouldn't be my best teaching self if I pretended to look busy, even if I didn't need to be. And it shakes me to my core, though, sometimes, because I have colleagues that are just mean. Well, that's number one. Like, that happens because I don't do things the way they do, but I can still achieve my outcomes. So the balance part in terms of I don't sit at my desk in a traditional way because sometimes I need to just step away and think. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I'm not working, but I'm not working in the way that they do. And because I don't match them, it's just hard. Mm-hmm. As uneloquent as that sounds.
Right. It's a feeling of other and sort of being odd.
And then not connected, right? Like I think, so one of the reasons in December I was struggling was I wasn't connected. And I think we're all going through this right now. You know, we have to physically distance where you don't touch people. Like, that's so hard. So my parents have been vaccinated, and I can tell you, hugging them for the first time when they were vaccinated was like the greatest relief, because you're like, oh my God, the chances of me likely having the virus are zero. I talk to nature, nobody else. I don't even go to a grocery store because I hate grocery shopping. But just that we've lost that connection because we can't touch people. We're not supposed to see people. Don't go to people's houses. It's cold. Like, you're not going to spend that much time outside with people. Like, we've lost that sense of connection. And I think that's also what's made my job so hard, is that I don't feel a sense of connection with the people that I work with. And without that sense of connection, no matter how passionate you are, the loss of connection is greater than the sense of passion. Hmm.
Do you think that there are ways of shifting the system or shifting your own place in the system? Or how do you imagine moving forward?
Not working in the department I'm currently working in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm working in an engineering communication program. Like, it's wonderful, but I miss the technical side. Like, I love the leadership and communication and professional side of it. I think it's awesome. I really see what we don't have at U of T, the University of Toronto, because I know U of T is also the title of many American schools. So at the University of Toronto in engineering, we don't have a department in engineering that liaises with kinesiology. And I think there is so much on the kinesiology side, from like AI, so artificial intelligence, machine learning, quite literally like different prototypes and different things that you can engineer and change. And I'd love to see a program start there. And the dean we have right now is wonderful. Like, he's a new dean. I'm so sorry his first year is in a pandemic year. And he's got great visions for the university, or for the faculty, and he really wants to work with as many faculties across the university as possible. Like, just such a wonderful individual. And even if I don't work at U of T doing something like that, I think something else will open up somewhere else. Or maybe I'm just meant to, I don't believe in like, not that I don't believe, I don't want the 20-year job. You know, part of me is like, well, maybe I can go be a lecturer or an instructor and like go to different universities and see the world, right? Like, I don't need to stay here.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Then you can sort of see this experience you're in as just sort of, oh, isn't that interesting? This is the circumstance and it doesn't really fit me right now. And that's good information to have, rather than being sort of emotionally attached to a certain sense of inclusion that you're never going to change the system, quite frankly, right? I mean, maybe you could inch it in one way, but, you know, it sort of is what it is. So I do think having a sense of phases and chapters is freeing.
Totally.
Yeah. I want to make sure that we circle back to this idea that you brought up at the very beginning of flight and how you've been thinking about flying. And you've mentioned to me that you have a fear of flying itself. So let's wrap that into also your reflections on birds and Wazelle and some of the common characteristics that that go into lift and thrust and steady flight.
So I do not have a fear of commercial airlines anymore. As a kid, I was really afraid of flying over the ocean and probably missed out on some pretty cool adventures with my family because I like literally would not get in on an airplane. I was adamant. I can't fly over the ocean. And then one day when we were flying to Vancouver to go up to Whistler and ski as a family, I was like, I'm flying over the ocean. I'm okay. And probably a pivot point in my life where I was like, I think I'm okay with big airplanes now. Little airplanes are different. When I first met my partner, Raul, his best friend and part of his family, they were killed in a small plane crash. So his best friend was flying a small plane I can't remember if he was trying to land on the water or on a small runway on an island, but the wind shear got them. And I'll leave it at that. Yeah. So I was like, we'll leave the gory details.
Didn't end up well.
And you know, I never got to meet Rocco, I'm really sad I never got to meet Rocco. I know Rocco is still with us and looking out for Raul all the time. I got a great picture of Rocco on my fridge, but that really watching, and I got to know Rocco's wife, Judy, too. And like her dad and cousin were in the plane too. And it was the tragedy around that, just like it shook me to the core.
Yeah.
And so I have a fear of small planes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I could get over it and like get in one. I'm not going to get in one tomorrow, but I think in a trusting environment, I would be ready to get in one, just knowing that it's got to be like the perfect flying day. I'm also, as I say, I don't think I'm afraid of dying anymore. So when I met my partner, and actually before he lost his friend Rocco, they weren't close friends, but they were very young people. One was the sister of my sister's best friend, and she got viral myocarditis probably on an airplane flying back from Toronto to London and died at the age of 24. She died over 4 days. And about a week before that, Nick Zoricic, who was World Cup ski cross racer, died in a very tragic ski cross accident due to lack of safety. And Nick would come, I was a ski coach for many years, and Nick would come back to the ski club, and his ability to inspire and hang out with 6 and 7 year olds was the greatest thing I ever saw. And that was a pivotal moment in my life where I let go. And I said, okay, you have to live every day like it's your last because you don't know. And I've been a lot happier since then, for sure. But as that, and letting go probably let me take flight if I think about it. Mm-hmm. In 2015, meeting the Wazell family was one of the greatest things that will ever happen to me. And it's the sponsorship has been wonderful. But it's so much bigger than that. The group of Vole that are the women who basically support the various programs that Wazell has, whether it be the Elite Athletes, the Bras for Girls program, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion ventures that they're getting into now. It is a host of women who only want to lift each other up. And when you put people like that together, it is one of the greatest fabrics that you can be a part of in life. And all of a sudden you're like the sheet billowing in the wind and you are a teeny tiny speck of that. And even when the sheet dips down and you're dipping down, you know you're going to go back up because you're connected to other people who are only there to lift you up.
So you feel a sense of the metaphor of flight being with the Wazell community. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that for many people, flight and the airplane sort of becomes a metaphor for liberation. And, you know, there's sort of the metaphor and then there's actually kind of becoming an operator of that liberation. And when you're speaking about becoming part of the Wazell team and learning what it's like to be in control of that feeling of being in the air, of flying, of weightlessness, of the sort of coordination between the mind and the body with other people. It is like, I mean, it's a learning to fly. It's so similar to how one would describe like literally learning how to control an airplane, you know, and sometimes people experience immense level of anxiety when they're up in the air. Mm-hmm. And honestly, many pilots every single time, you know, you walk out there, you have to overcome that bit of fear. I mean, it's not completely natural to be in a capsule, you know, thousands of feet above the ground, right?
Right.
It's just not. So it's like totally, you know, it's sort of that Brené Brown, like the fear and the courage are just,
yeah,
both need to show up, really. And that's so transferable to what you're doing and how you're speaking about being part of that team. And that's so transferable to approaches to life, too. I get a sense that you really celebrate that.
I try to. I'm not always very good at it. Again, as you pointed out from Doha, I'm still human. But I think
thank
to your
goodness.
Point, right? Oh, thank goodness. To your point about liberation, you know, that moment as the plane takes off, and I'm not a pilot, but when I'm in a commercial like airplane, there's something pretty powerful when the plane gets lift. I can't imagine how much stronger that is as a pilot and just like the sensation of how cool that is. But with respect to liberation, I think to get that liftoff point and to leave the ground, you can do it because you've got this fabric above you where, you know, like there's in a way, like you've got this high pressure underneath you that's like almost a feeling like holding you back. But the second that you get up there and you feel above you, there's this like light pressure and probably freedom up there, but you have to have a fabric to be able to have liberation. Like you can, like for sure, some people can do it on their own. I think all of us need that fabric of community for that liberation because I can't have courage without knowing that someone's there in case I fall.
Yeah. I mean, at the core, we're so relational.
One of the things I was just playing with in my head is Brené Brown's Fear and Courage and Lift and Weight and Drag and Thrust. And fear and courage are in equal, they have to be in equilibrium. For you to really be able to do whatever it is you're trying to do, you have to have a balance of both in a sense.
Right. Or you fall. I mean, at some point, right? Sooner than later.
Or your ego is so big that you then get smooshed down.
Right. Which is one of the danger signs of being a pilot is an ego that's so big that it dominates. Yeah. How does spirituality come into play for you?
The short answer is I don't know. But I sort of know. So I have Jewish roots. I was raised Jewish. I was raised Jewish in the sense of community. And when I had the opportunity in 2013 to go to Israel and compete at the Maccabi Games, I really identified with their version of being Jewish, which really is a sense of community. In terms of spirituality, I think there's a whole sense of spirits out there. Like I really believe in the spirits of the trees and that they're connected through their roots. And they talk through their branches and their leaves. And I think that there's spirits in the water. And I think that there's spirits in the air. And maybe that's in that indigenous First Nations type culture that I need to learn a little bit more, right? They have many spirits. And I think it's really important to think about something that's greater than yourself in terms of spirituality. But I don't go to church and I don't go on Sundays and I don't go to shul. I do go outside to be with the spirits every day. So I don't know how that's any different.
Yeah, I totally understand. I think what you are speaking to is a sense of spirituality independent of organized structure.
Yes.
And I don't think we need to apologize for that, right? It sort of is what it is. And there is absolutely something spiritual about going for a run on any old unassuming day or incredibly important day.
Right.
You know, it's the way that many of us walk in this world. So something else I wanted to ask you about, when we talked earlier, you talked about loving to make fast turns.
Ugh.
And you sort of said it offhandedly. We were talking about skiing and running on the track,
yeah.
But it really sort of hung with me of what a crazy and sort of unique thing to identify as something that you just love. It's just making fast turns and speed and turns. So tell me how you've reflected on that and what you can share with us.
Okay, so the first reflection is I'm really practicing on my Nordic skis with no edges.
Okay.
And we have this like downhill that comes back to my friend's house and like they always ski past the like entrance back to their property. And I make the fast turn now. And it's fear and courage, right? Like I am terrified that I am going to like wipe out, hit a tree, like mess myself up. But there is something so amazing about thinking like, I can do this. Like I'm going to make this turn. There's like all the rotational forces and everything. Like it is so much fun on the track. particularly on a bank track, when you, and like the higher the bank, the cooler this is. So you start kind of on the lee side of the bank so that you're coming up and over it. And basically as you sprint almost as fast as you can on the outside lane so that you're, you have the most downhill in a sense as you come around the corner, like the centripetal forces that you can generate. And like, it's you, right? You are the only machine generating those forces. It is so incredible and so freeing and liberating and like beautiful. And then my absolute favorite place to do it is on, you can't do it in Ontario because there's no mountains. They're too tiny, but on a mountain. So I love alpine skiing. Like, wanted to be a World Cup alpine racer. I'm built like a marathoner. It was never going to happen. I tried super hard to get there and really worked at my skiing. And there, when you can be weightless at the top of the turn and you allow gravity to take over, there is a feeling of flight like no other. And you have to, one, totally trust yourself because you're basically diving straight down a mountain, essentially trying to go as fast as you can. But again, it's this like fear and courage, like, oh my God, I'm going to get going so fast. But that feeling that you can create makes all of those moments worth it. And if we like step out of sport, like love is totally one of those moments, right? Like when you really fall in love with someone, it is the scariest thing that you can ever do, but it is the most worthwhile thing you could ever do.
It's like they're just all versions of jumping, a jump of faith.
Totally.
It's like you give it all you can and it will give back to you. And there is risk involved, but you know, without taking that risk, oh, life looks very different.
So I have a tattoo on my arm and it says, "What if you fly?" And it's from the poem, "What if I fall? Oh, but my darling, what if you fly?"
I love it. And I feel like I have said it or heard it or all of the above. It's like so captures the entire spirit of this podcast. Do you have any additional message that you would like to share on sport, empowering community, women, having a life that is, you know, your own script or any of those themes?
I mean, I think it's the risk, right? Like take the risk. I mean, surround yourself with a community that's going to pick you up if you fall. If I think back to my childhood, like I love using the line, my parents gave me enough rope to hang myself with and I sure did hang myself out there, but they were there to pull the rope back in. And it let me take those risks in life. And I am forever grateful and thankful because it's given me the courage as I've gotten older to take those risks, but also to pass that on to other generations, to younger generations, but also to pass that back to my mom when she calls me and says like, I don't know. And I'm like, Mom, you gave me the, like, go do this. I'm here. And she's like, okay, thanks. No problem. Bye.
You sort of pay it forward, pay it back.
Yeah.
It just become a channel to that energy of, yes, we can risk. And yes, we're there to hold each other and to catch each other. Yeah. It's really beautiful.
I think kindness too. If I, you know, when you say that don't be there for someone if you're going to be mean when they take a risk, because you will deter them from doing anything risky again in their life. And I think risk and kindness must go together.
Mm. Yeah, we could all have more kindness in our worlds, couldn't we? Oh, Sasha, where can we find out more about you and your work and follow you and your competitive circuit?
Mostly on socials. I've unfortunately been really bad with my blog and my website lately. So on socials, I'm S. Gaulish Runs. There's two L's in my last name. And I know you'll probably stick stuff in the show notes, so I'm not too worried about the spelling. And I really try to be authentic on socials. You're going to hear a pretty raw, real story on my social media. It's not all roses, that's for sure.
And I would also say your website, although, you know, you may not have updated it, you know, most recently, I don't think that really matters. I think a lot of what you have up there are sort of evergreen topics and thoughts. And I don't know, I really got a lot out of exploring around your blog and your writing. And you know, you have a really unique way of thinking about what you do and having this engineering mindset and overlaying that on some of the things that a lot of us do, but we don't necessarily bring that same lens. It's just really fascinating.
Thank you.
So So thank you so much for sharing.
Always.
This has been really fun. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for listening to the When Women Fly podcast. My hope is that you leave this conversation with a sense of curiosity and empowerment to hold on to what is important and let go to what weighs you down. Stare fear in the face. If you like this episode of the When Women Fly podcast, be sure to share and subscribe and let us know what you think. We love feedback. Be brave, be bold, and fly. See you next time.